Coming up on this episode...
Entire chunks of her life were just missing after she underwent electroshock to the brain. Her writing sort of resembled the troubled state of her own mind.
Found writing as the thing that anchors me to this world. I knew I was going to be a writer from the minute I picked up a pencil.
This podcast from Georgia Public Broadcasting highlights books with Georgia connections, hosted by your two favorite public radio book nerds who also happen to be your hosts of All Things Considered on GPB Radio. I'm Peter Biello.
And I'm Orlando Montoya. Thanks for joining us as we introduce you to authors, their writings, and the insights behind their stories, mixed with our own ideas and thoughts about just what gives these works the narrative edge. All right, Peter, so we all have trouble.
Are you singing to me? Is this a song?
It sounds like a song.
It sounds like a song.
We all have
trouble.
We all
have trouble.
We all have hardship, but we overcome it. And I'm thinking of a lot of songs that I could talk about with regard to that subject. But today's book is like a song that lifts us up in hard times.
Okay.
And it's going through some really, really difficult topics, I got to say. But through understanding how one woman overcomes her challenges, it really becomes inspirational. We can learn from it.
So you were inspired by this book?
Definitely inspired by this book. And let me say that if I could sing this book, maybe put a chorus to it, a dramatic key change, it would be a hit.
All right. Well, sounds inspirational to me, but tell me about it. Who wrote it? What's the title?
All right. So we're talking about Mama May Be Mad by Carrie Neville. She teaches writing at Georgia College and State University in Milledgeville. This is her memoir. And in it, she talks about her mental health challenges, you know, things that a lot of people have. So anorexia, alcohol addiction, bipolar disorder, suicidal thoughts. So, she almost reached the very bottom of these conditions, but she spiraled down and then she spiraled back up. And so this book is about that journey.
Okay. A lot of memoirs out there in the marketplace, a lot of them about mental illness. Can you tell us a bit about what sets this one apart? Why is it interesting enough to have a memoir about her life in particular?
Well, Carrie is a writer, so she's not okay. Like your Uncle Jack sitting down and writing the story of his life. She has published some well-received books, some short fiction, and so she's good at connecting things. She's good at making images and turns of phrases. She's very good with the use of language. This is almost like poetry. There are sections of this book that are not, you know, sort of a typical memoir, like I did this, A, B, C, D. It's more like shadows and light. And you know how I like sort of shadows and light in my poetry. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's really a work of literature. It's a work of art. And here's how Carrie Neville describes why she wrote the book.
But really, it was the need to write about what happens once you get to the other side of, that wall. If you suffer from mental health difficulties, complexities, sometimes you don't know there's possibility on the other side. And so I wanted to write about, what I call my sort of dark well times, which begin the book. But really the book is more about what happens after you find a way around the wall or over the wall and find joy. And
so I understand the skepticism. You know, a lot of people write memoirs, but I hope that I can convince you that this memoir, like the last one that I presented, is worth the read. It's also a very, a relatively short book. It's about 250 pages, so you can go through it rather quickly.
Well, for this book, I mean, what you were describing, addiction, bipolar disorder, depression, pretty dark stuff, right? So how much of the book dwells in that darkness?
So the book is divided roughly into three equal parts. And the first part I'll describe as she describes it, the bottom of the well. So that first third is really the most difficult. She goes into her time in mental health facilities, cutting herself, some seriously underweight conditions when she had anorexia. She was drinking. She wanted to kill herself. And she underwent electroconvulsive therapy. And so the second part, that's the part about overcoming. That's the part that I thought where she made a turn in her condition. And she talks about her children. She talks about getting a divorce because I got the impression that, you know, moving away from that person was something that helped her in her journey as well. She talked about moving to Georgia and other reasons that she turned the corner. And then the third section is what I'll call spring, flowers blooming, future possibilities, things that she was doing at the time of writing the book, and sort of what she's looking at in terms of her future. And that's inspiring as well. So again, I don't think it's a memoir like, this is my childhood, that I'm doing this, that I'm doing this. It really is a journey.
Since we mentioned suicide, I should note that if anybody listening or watching on YouTube is thinking about suicide, you can find help by calling 988. I want to ask about the inspiration part in a little bit, but I want to question a little bit about the electroshock therapy part. Did she describe going through that treatment?
Yes, very much. So this destroyed her memory. Entire chunks of her life were just missing after she underwent electroshock to the brain. I can't remember how many treatments, but it was at least a dozen, maybe two dozen. And this electroconvulsive therapy made her memory kind of like it wasn't even a jumble. Like my memory can be a jumble sometimes. Like
whose can't, really? Yeah.
But she just, it was all erased. It was like somebody took the electromagnetic tape and just went, and it was all gone.
What was gone specifically? Like stuff around that time?
Around that time, okay. Yes. And then things with her children, photographs that she would see and say, I have no idea what that was. And we should say that, as a disclaimer, that this is not a medical show. We're not giving advice, and electroconvulsive therapy is a very effective treatment for many people. But Carrie certainly has nothing good to say about it or the doctor that she calls Dr. Disregard.
Well, how do you write about this kind of thing if you have lapses in memory? What happens there?
So she had to become like us. She had to become kind of like a journalist.
So going through sort of records that she could, what kind of records, I mean, does she rely on to sort of fill the gaps in her memory?
Well, she talks about it here.
It's a matter of excavation, I think. A lot of people assume maybe writing a memoir doesn't involve significant research, right? I mean, you go into it thinking, I'm writing about me, the most egotistical thing I can do, right? I know everything about me. I know everything about my story. But regardless, I think when you write memoir, it is an act of discovery, right? So you have to sort of dig in and, you know, talk to people who, you know, live with you or lived around you. I was very lucky that, you know, I've always found writing as the thing that anchors me to this world. I knew I was going to be a writer from the moment I picked up a pencil, you know, or a crayon. So I always have these journals, you know, and so I kept journals then that were contemporaneous. So they're pretty grim, you know, I have to say. But I'm lucky that I sort of kept writing during that time.
Okay, so she had journals that she could rely on.
Yeah, so journals, medical records, emails, talking with people, sort of, you know, becoming a journalist about her own life. So that's how she got to know her own story.
So you've said a few times that she writes about overcoming the dark chapters of her life. You mentioned recovery, but you haven't really said how she did it. How did she recover? Was there one thing? Was it a menu of things?
Yeah, it was a menu of things. Mm-hmm. Obviously, sobriety. She was. She had substance use disorder, alcoholism, divorce. Like I said before, sort of moving into a new place, getting on her own, sort of learning that she could function on her own was a very good thing for her. What it means to be herself in relation to other people, without the relation to the one. But there was one story in the book that kind of functions as a climax, and that is her interaction with one of her former doctors, the one that I referred to before, that is called in the book simply Dr. Disregard.
And, you know, I was sitting there, he had called me in, you know, I was in another outpatient program, trying to get my weight stabilized, trying to, you know, deal with my daily suicidal ideation. And, you know, he called me into his office and there was this giant folder, you know, between us. I write about this in that scene. And he just kind of, you know, was dismissive. You know, he said, you know, you're a hope. I mean, this is what he said to me. He said, you're a hopeless case. I don't know. Something about that in that moment, you know, hit me in the most stubborn, willful part of myself. And because this is public radio, I can't repeat on air what I said to him. But suffice it to say, it was a very direct response. And I walked out of that office. And I would say I walked back, I mean, not immediately fully into my life, but that was a moment where I was like, oh, I get to decide who I am. I get to decide what recovery is going to look like.
So is that ethical to say that you're to a patient, hey, you're a hopeless case?
Well, my read on it is that the doctor was telling her that you're hopeless, as in you think you're hopeless, right? So it wasn't him telling her that. That was his read on it. But
interesting,
anyways,
word choice if so.
Well,
but okay.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Disregard is one of only two people in the book that are not named by their actual names. The other one is her ex-husband. She refers to her ex-husband simply as X. So
that's, presumably for good legal reasons, if both of these people are still alive, let's rename them.
Yeah.
So I understand how this book could have the narrative edge based on what you're saying about the inspirational factor. You also mentioned the artistry earlier, so I'd love for you to tell me a little more about that. I mean, what about the language you mentioned gives this book?
Yeah. So that's,
edge?
I think that's the genius of the book. Although it's not original, one thing that she does in this book is that her writing style goes from very chaotic and messy and mishmash and helter-skelter at the beginning to more of what you would read in a magazine towards the end.
So by helter-skelter in the beginning, do you mean like it's asking you to sort of feel the way it feels to be caught up
exactly.
in all these, I see.
Yeah,
so it's intentional, in other words.
Exactly.
It's not like a sloppy writing job.
That's the intention. You know, the ideas don't flow in the first part of the book. The ideas ricochet. And so they go bang, bang, bang. And I can understand it because that's the way my brain works sometimes. So I really appreciated that. And I compare that actually to the writing of one of my favorite writers, Conrad Aiken, the poet who was born in Savannah and is buried in Savannah, 1889 to 1973. He's sometimes referred to as the Bard of Consciousness, and he writes often about the state of consciousness and what it is to be in your mind and all that. So I think that the beginning of the book where her writing sort of resembled the troubled state of her own mind. And I think that was very genius.
Well, how's she doing now? I mean, this was how many years ago?
Six or seven years ago.
Okay, so that's a good amount of time.
Well, yeah, she's doing good. I asked her about that. You know, she still writes. She still teaches. She tries as much as possible to stay on the sunny side of the street.
I had to find ways to find and hold fast to hope. So that's how I'm doing now, is that there are hard days, and there's hard days for everybody. I mean, you know, not just in our personal lives, but, you know, nationally, globally. I still find ways to hold fast to hope each day.
And what does give you hope?
What does give me hope?
Well, what gives you joy? I mean,
horses. I'm back to riding horses again. If you've read the book, you know that horses and riding horses were a big part of what helped me stay in very dark years. You know, I worked with abused, neglected horses at a stable. So I'm back to riding horses once a week. And I have to say, it's the most blissful hour and a half. Well, it's more like 3 hours because the drive and the tacking up of my life.
And how can you not feel happy around horses, you know? And so since we're talking about what gives her hope, I will tell you that things that give me hope these days, friends, going to karaoke, I have a new condo that I'm, you know, taking much interest in.
Trivia, so you play trivia?
Play trivia every week. And you, I don't have to ask you what gives you joy these days.
Yep, certainly. My son turns 14 months pretty soon, so he gives me hope. But also, like, I was doing a story last week about a food bank where I met people who were really dedicated to just helping other people who were down on their luck. And you know, you hear so much bad news, right, about people doing awful things to one another. And then you meet this just pocket of goodness that people are giving so much of themselves. It's nice to see. It really was nice to see.
Well, you know, here's a person who at one point in her life didn't want to be here. Mm-hmm. And here she is. And so what better kind of an inspirational story is that? If you are facing mental health problems, you know, call 988. We always say that. And so take care of yourself, everybody. Take care of yourself.
Absolutely. The book is Mama May Be Mad by Carrie Neville. Orlando, thanks for telling me about it.
Thank you.
You know, every day on Up First, NPR's Golden Globe-nominated morning news podcast, we bring you three essential stories. At the heart of each story are questions. What really happened? What really mattered? What happens next? At NPR, we stand for your right to be curious and to follow the facts. Follow Up First wherever you get your podcasts and start your day knowing what matters and why.